From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Many of us picture Charles Darwin as a solemn, unsmiling old man with a wizardly beard, a fitting image for a man who gave us the paradigm-inverting theory of evolution.
And we all recall his travels on the HMS Beagle around the globe to exotic places like the Galapagos Islands, observing finches, tortoises, and iguanas.
But as readers learn in James Costa's new book, Darwin's Backyard, how small experiments led to a big theory, Darwin was far from an ivory tower elitist. Rather, many of his insights and theories sprung from spirited collaboration with colleagues, friends, and even his children as they observed simple acts of nature in their own backyards.
James Costa joins us in the first part of the show to talk about his book, Darwin's Life, and how we can perform many of the same experiments Darwin performed in our own backyard.
And then in the second half of the show, we've got some news items to cover. Big event going on in Bonn, Germany.
That's right.
Related to the Paris Climate Accords and some efforts by countries to start assembling plans of action to reduce carbon emissions, right?
That's right. It's no easy task.
No easy task.
As we've learned from this past week, and we'll give you the update.
Some details on what's going on and what the U.S. is doing there. Yeah, exactly. All right. We don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth, or you can just text Nell.
That's right. You can text me if you've got my cell number. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain instructors share their love of skiing and snowboarding with guests, helping them improve their skills and enjoy the mountain. More information on Ski and Snowboard School and other programs at parkcitymountain.com.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and company support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch Counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome to This Green Earth. It's a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us on the phone is our first guest. He's James Costas. He's the author of the new book, Darwin's Backyard, How Small Experiments Led to a Big Theory. James is a professor of biology at Western Carolina University and a trustee of the Charles Darwin Trust. And we'll talk a little bit about that later on. But first of all, James, thanks so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Oh, sure thing. Hello, Chris. Hello, Nell. Great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. Lots of questions. Great book. Fascinating. And with experiments that we can run in our own. Take the book into the classroom, and we'll talk about that, too. But I guess I thought we would start just going back and give us a little briefing or summary about Charles Darwin and kind of the arc of his educational career, let's say, as he moved his way into science, because that was not his original intent or maybe his father's intent. True?
Mm. Yeah. That's certainly true. He had maybe an unpromising beginning in some ways educationally. You know, he was a bit of a ne'er-do-well in school, maybe, you know, from a modern perspective, bored a lot of the time. I mean, he loved being outdoors. He loved, you know, naturalizing, hunting, you know, riding his horses and those sorts of things. And he had, I guess, a privileged upbringing, of course,
right.
and a very good education, certainly by, you know, standards of the time. He's very, very privileged, but not terribly interested in kind of classical studies. And his father, who was a well-known physician, expected that his sons, his older brother Erasmus, and then Charles Darwin himself, you know, they would follow in his footsteps. And the older brother, Erasmus, went off to Edinburgh to medical school, and Charles followed. But it was really a disaster. And, you know, he just had no stomach for the horrors of the operating table, you know, and you can imagine just how horrible it was in those days.
Right. This is this is back when? 18...
Yes. Well, so this would be in the 1820s.
Wow. Okay.
And so Darwin was born in 1809. And he was born and grew up in the market town of Shrewsbury in the west of England. And his father, Robert Darwin, was a very well established physician in the town there.
Okay, so he kind of washes out of med school, and then moves on to perhaps, do I have this right? Did he go to Cambridge perhaps to become a cleric?
Exactly. That was the plan. You know, he went to Cambridge, and the idea would have been, I mean, you know, Cambridge was the place where you would train for the church. Mm. But, you know, gentlemen would go there to sort of finish their education, maybe without planning on taking holy orders. But Charles Darwin did plan at that point. His father, you know, did plan, but sorry about that, to go ahead and complete his theological training. You know, his father thought that would be a respectable career for his son. You know, as a young gentleman, I mean, you needed some kind of respectable career, and medicine wasn't going to be it. Law was not going to be it. He had no real faculty for languages and such. Studying the classics, so law was out, and theology would have fit him very, very nicely because, you know, I think the ministers of the day were often very well-regarded naturalists. You know, they would often have a country church somewhere, a parish. They would certainly tend to their flock, but then they would also be free to, you know, indulge their interest in the natural world. And this was the heyday of a kind of theological movement, maybe, that we would call natural theology,
wow,
which entailed trying to gain insight or an appreciation of the divine, really by studying nature. And so Charles Darwin, you know, that would have resonated very deeply with him. So yes, in moving to Cambridge, he did plan on ultimately becoming a vicar.
And you also talk about how Darwin was kind of this like old-fashioned natural philosopher at a time when that practice was starting to give way to more professionalized science. So talk about that dynamic a little bit and how that interacted with his career.
That certainly is true more and more as the 19th century wears on. I mean, early on, you know, the kind of science that Darwin did, what we would regard as just good old-fashioned natural history, was very much in vogue. And really, all of the sciences had their foundation in a firm empiricism, firmly understanding the natural world. You know, the up-and-coming science of geology, you know, chemistry was an exciting experimental science. But later in the century, Darwin's brand of carrying out science at home became, you know, decidedly out of fashion. You know, the professionalization of science, the universities that would support, you know, the construction of laboratories and different kinds of scientific undertakings, the formalization of scientific method and analysis, all of that, you know, served to move science out of the home, really, where it was conducted by very, you know, privileged people since time immemorial, into institutions, you know, the museums and the universities. And even in those days, by the late 19th century, purpose-built more egalitarian universities where you would have professional science. So science as a profession that and a meritocracy is really a relatively new thing, a late 19th century phenomenon.
So here he is in Cambridge studying theology, and he takes this amazing interest, as you write, in beetles and collecting beetles. And that seems to be kind of a watershed moment in his educational career?
I mean, it's really funny from a modern perspective, you know, just what Beatlemania meant to those undergraduates at Cambridge.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a period, and this was the heyday of natural history, maybe in the Victorian period in general, you know, people of all walks of life just, you know, enthused about collecting, you know, ferns or shells or whatever they might be. And Darwin's particular mania that he discovered when he was in Cambridge was beetles. And it almost became a blood sport. I mean, they were really hotly competitive. Who could get the rarest beetles? Who had the finest collection? They would hire collectors that would go out and you know, kind of beat the bushes trying to get rarities. Darwin almost came to blows with one guy that he had been hiring to go collect for him, only to find he was giving first pick to one of his rivals.
Oh.
He was just hopping mad about that. From a more sort of scientific perspective, modern historians in some cases look back at that and they sort of you can recognize in Darwin's Beatlemania maybe his first very in-depth introduction to exuberant diversity of a group. You know, I mean, beetles are, you know, the single largest group of animals on Earth, actually. Hmm. I mean, it's a tremendously diverse group. So even in relatively species-poor Britain, you've got really nice beetle diversity, you know, tremendous diversity, variations, rare variants. And so it's possible that, you know, he first became attuned to just the abundance of diversity and variation by immersing himself in the collection of beetles.
We're speaking with James Costa. He's a professor of biology at Western Carolina University and the author of the new book, Darwin's Backyard, How Small Experiments Led to a Big Theory. We're you know, talking about the initial arc of Darwin's career here, how he became interested, and eventually he takes on the concepts, ideas of science, becoming a scientist, which in itself was a term that was being developed back then, to become a full-time, full-fledged scientist. Who was his mentors and guides back then?
Darwin was very fortunate. You know, he had some outstanding mentors there at Cambridge. You know, all of the faculty were clerics. And one in particular, John Stevens Henslow, was a very well-regarded botanist and was one of his professors. Very kindly, very, very knowledgeable. Darwin became known as the man who walks with Henslow. You know, after church on Sundays, Henslow would lead these country rambles where they would botanize. And Darwin was just the eager beaver, maybe a little bit too much so in some cases, by some accounts. You know, then there were others too. You know, Adam Sedgwick was a minister, but also a very well known geologist. And Darwin ultimately got a crash course in the fundamentals of field geology with Henslow. And there were other inspirations that his professors would have encouraged him to read. For example, Alexander von Humboldt.
Right.
You know, Humboldt's travels to the New World and his writings about his travels in South America and Mexico, I mean, really electrified young naturalists, you know, and Darwin had this burning, burning desire to travel. You know, he longed to see exotic locales and follow in the footsteps of Humboldt. And at the same time, you know, people like Humboldt, they were asking very big picture questions. There were some very pressing, I guess you could think of them as very, very pressing philosophical questions about the nature of species and varieties and why are they distributed as we see them on Earth? What is the nature of the fossil record as fossils were becoming better and better understood? And even some of his professors were in the process of describing geological periods, and several of them still bear the names that professors like Sedgwick applied, like the Cambrian and the Ordovician. You know, it was a hot and exciting time where ancient life was being unveiled. And again, it raised these big philosophical questions. You know, why do you have this succession of extinct forms? You know, is there a plan? Is it an unfolding divine plan? Or is there something else at work? And so, you know, his professors, I think, truly inspired him to realize that, you know, this could be his calling. You know, rather than taking holy orders and becoming a minister, perhaps he could become a naturalist, you know, in the mold of a Humboldt.
And so how does he make that transition from being a student at Cambridge and, you know, dreaming about these exotic locales and traveling to actually, you know, getting on the Beagle and sailing to the Galapagos and becoming so well known for those things?
Yeah. Well, you know, in short, he lucked out. I mean, he really did. I mean, certainly his professors saw in him great potential. I mean, he was in his element. He clearly came into his own with his exuberant love of natural history, his ardent botanizing, his beetling, and all of those things. But really, you know, he was not, as you would expect, of course, you know, about the time he graduated then, about 1831, he was not, of course, a finished or seasoned naturalist. He was really just out of college, you know. But he really did luck out in that there was a Royal Navy expedition planned that was a little bit unusual in that the captain, one Robert Fitzroy, wanted to have a gentleman accompany him on the voyage. And there are some interesting reasons for that I won't get into now. But he wanted companionship, and Darwin seemed to fit the bill. You know, the position was offered to some other naturalists that were better known, bigger names, more seasoned. And Henslow was one of them. And Henslow recognized that, you know, well, he couldn't do it. He had a growing family. He had obligations to his church. And, you know, there's just too much going on. But here's, you know, unencumbered, you know, young Darwin, just out of college, unmarried, eager beaver.
Right.
And so he recommended, you know, the young Charles Darwin to Fitzroy as a candidate for the position. And it's funny that he almost didn't get the job because apparently Fitzroy was a devotee of phrenology, and the, you know, this sort of pseudoscience where you can kind of read characteristics of people's character and talents and abilities by the shape of their head, features of their face, bumps on their head, you know, those sorts of things. And Darwin later recounted in his autobiography that he almost didn't get the job because Fitzroy thought that someone with his nose clearly, you know, just was going to be wanting in energy. You know?
Wow. No kidding.
Darwin then said he later was very satisfied that my nose had spoken falsely.
I also like the fact that the moment the ship went under sail, he got sick, and he was deathly ill with a large part of the journey.
Virtually every moment on the journey, you know, I've not done this myself, but I have heard and read accounts where if you added up all the time, it was an almost 5-year voyage, and if you added up all the time that Darwin was actually on the ship during the 5 years, it would add up to only about 18 months. And that's an indication of his seasickness. It was chronic, you know, he's always some shade of green on that voyage.
Right.
And the captain, you know, Fitzroy took pity on him. He would give him opportunities to go ashore whenever possible, and sometimes really extended excursions inland where he would go collecting. And so that actually, you know, it dovetailed very nicely with his main activity on the ship, which was as a de facto naturalist, you know, breaking with tradition, maybe. You know, the Royal Navy at that time would often have a naturalist aboard these official expeditions, but often they would be the surgeon of the ship. Mm. But in this case, the surgeon was not, or in a de facto kind of way, you know, was not the naturalist, and he was actually rather miffed about that. But Darwin then, in his role as gentleman naturalist, would then go ashore and avoid, you know, getting vomiting on board, and collect all sorts of things, you know, plants and birds and fossils and insects,
and then ship them all back.
Ship them back. Yes.
So yeah. Locker after locker after locker of specimens shipped back, where he then spent time studying them afterwards when he got back.
And he didn't study them very much himself afterwards either. And he was surprised, maybe pleasantly surprised, to learn that, you know, first of all, he was making detailed observations, so writing very detailed letters back to his professors, and then also sending specimens back. And then at the learned societies, you know, the Geological Society, the Entomological Society, the Zoological Society, his various professors and others would share with the, you know, with the assembled members Darwin's latest observations, discoveries. In some cases, they'd be describing his specimens, and he already really had achieved quite a name for himself even before he got home. But still, when he did get home, it's fair to say, I mean, he still was not a very well-trained naturalist in any one area.
Right.
So he wouldn't be the one logically to be describing, let's say, his birds or his mammals or his plants. So they would get farmed out to various specialists. And they, in studying them, would then report back to Darwin, to his amazement, just how special many of these collections turned out to be.
I tell you what, we have to take a break. We're at the bottom of the hour. That might be a nice place to stop. Can you spend a few more minutes with us, James?
Absolutely, sure.
Fantastic. We'll pick things up from there about his work that he does back home, who does it, his discoveries, and then, of course, the work that he continues to do literally in his backyard. Again, speaking with James Costa, he's the author of the new book, Darwin's Backyard, How Small Experiments Led to a Big Theory. It's This Green Earth, and we'll be right back after a few of these messages. Stay tuned.
Support for KPCW programming comes from Campos Coffee. At Campos, they work closely with their growers 365 days a year to select the beans for their coffee. Their blends and single-origin coffees are roasted in-house and delivered each day. Campos Coffee, at the base of Park City Mountain Resort. CamposCoffee.com.
Hello, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage pickup provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. Garbage and recycling containers should be placed at the curb before 7 a.m. on your scheduled collection day. Keep Summit County green. SummitCounty.org/recycle.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And we're speaking with James Costa about his new book, Darwin's Backyard, How Small Experiments Led to a Big Theory. And so, James, just before the break there, you know, you mentioned that some of these specimens that Darwin was collecting and shipping back were just incredible. So tell us a little bit about what he was collecting and how it got back to the to England.
Well, I guess it was a point of pride for him. As he put it, he was diligent in collecting all departments of natural history, he said. And so this would be everything he could get his hands on, you know, mollusks and mammals and reptiles and plants and insects and such. And these would be sent back and ultimately described. You know, he had quite a task when he first got home, just sorting out, you know, some of his materials and kind of getting all of his ducks in a row and deciding who to send what to. And he was fortunate in getting a grant to work up his material, and ultimately there would be published volumes, you know, the zoology of the voyage. And that was very common in those days. There would be volumes published, describing the discoveries of these voyages. And I guess, you know, maybe two sets of observations in particular proved to be very important to him. He had farmed out his birds from the voyage to John Gould, who was a very well-established, well-known ornithologist there in London at the time. This would be like 1836, in 1836. And Gould had described these in a very, very rapidly in early in 1837, a whole series of papers. And in particular, he was very excited about his Galapagos specimens. And Gould discussed with Darwin in a personal meeting about, you know, this is very interesting. Not only were most of the birds he found in the Galapagos new species, but all were, you know, many of them were closely related to each other, and then as a group, closely related to birds of the South American mainland. And he thought that was very curious, you know, that there would be these unique species on these islands. In some cases, individual islands would have their own related species, and then as a group, they would be related to the mainland species. And around the same time, a paleontologist named Richard Owen had described Darwin's South American fossils, and in particular talked about these fascinating, giant, extinct versions of many of the same groups found in South America today. You know, the Glyptodon, for example, just these enormous armadillo-like creatures that are about as big as, you know, a VW bug or something, just these really phenomenal organisms. And this correspondence between, you know, the extinct and the living in the same general area seemed to stick with him. And by his own account later, it was Gould's observations and Owen's that really led him to this, eureka moment, really, where he thought, you know, the only thing that could really explain these various lines of observation in terms of the relationships and the distributions of these species must be the idea that species can change, that living species are descended from species that lived in the past. And that was a very, very exciting sort of lightning bolt moment for him.
And what was the reception like when he advanced this idea, this insight?
Well, he didn't advance it to anyone initially.
Ah.
You know, he really kept this to himself, recognizing that the topic of species change was really taboo. You know, it was an idea that was kicked around and debated pretty extensively during the Enlightenment period in the late 18th century. But by the time you know, Darwin was born, it had really fallen into disrepute, and so a respectable naturalist would have, put any credence at all into these ideas that species could change over time. It was considered disreputable at best. At worst, in some quarters, it was almost blasphemous and connected with kind of seditious revolutionary ideas. There's a whole interesting story there. So he really kind of kept this to himself for some years. It really wasn't until maybe the mid-1840s that he began to share, you know, his discovery and bounce the idea off of some very selected close friends.
Right, he kind of workshopped it, I guess you would say,
right.
these days. And I guess that's interesting because it seemed like Darwin was very, obviously he would run these, make these observations and experiments, and sometimes they would fail. And he was comfortable with that—the concept of failure, as a element or component in developing greater theories—and also open to criticism, like that.
Yeah, so yeah.
I guess he received quite a bit of it as he again workshopped this idea of evolution.
Yeah, that was certainly very helpful to him. You know, having a friendly but fierce critic in some of his friends. So even his cousin, William Darwin Fox, or his friend Joseph Hooker, the botanist, a sympathetic ear, but fierce critics that would really help him sharpen his ideas, identify the weaknesses, identify, you know, where do the problems lie, where do you need more evidence, and what kind of evidence. Over time, he did hone his ideas through these conversations, kind of workshopping that, as you put it. And eventually, I think that was all to good effect. You know, this sort of developed over a long period of time, you know, as he gestated the idea. And the experiments that he undertook were often really aimed at collecting the lines of evidence that would come up in these conversations. And failure, you know, that's pretty typical. I mean, Darwin would make fun of himself that these experiments they were sort of fool's experiments, and he would just sort of sheepishly, you know, kind of report, you know, his latest adventure or misadventure, and this really comes out beautifully in Darwin's letters and other sources, other people's accounts. And failure was no problem. He was typically undaunted. You know, he would just go back to the drawing board, or he would just give it another try with suitable tweaking, you know, of his methodological approach.
So I have to share one quote that you share in the book, which is in a letter from his wife, and she says, "He's taken to training earthworms, but does not make much progress, as they can neither see nor hear." And it sounds like they all had a bit of a sense of humor about these experiments that he was doing, you know, in and around the house. Is that right?
I think they really did, and again, it comes back to something that you said way at the beginning of the program, that, you know, the common perception of Darwin seen through the lens of these portraits, you know, that we most people know him through these portraits or pictures. He seems so serious and so melancholy and so dour. And the same is true of Emma, you know, her portraits. And it's just of the time, you know, that you would they were unsmiling, and they would just seem very, very serious and even sad, maybe, and it really belies the reality. And absolutely, I think the whole family really had a sense of humor about these things. They were all very good spirited about helping out, you know, helping conduct experiments, collect specimens, and sometimes, you know, just poking fun at their dad. The kids would, or Emma would, you know, in quotes like that one, you know, she would in her very, you know, with her dry sense of humor, she would just comment, and you can kind of almost sense there's an eye roll there. You know, he's at it again, you know.
Right. And he did a lot. You know, upon returning from the trip, he contracted an illness that was never quite, I guess, fully quantified or understood. Some suggest it might have been a parasite that he picked up in the tropics.
True,
so,
yeah.
But he never really traveled much after that, correct?
No. He, you know, early on, not in just a few years after the voyage, I mean, he ventured up to Scotland for one study. And speaking of failure, that was actually a study that did end in failure. Mm. He always called it his greatest blunder. Mm. Later, the family, you know, he became something of a homebody. You know, he married in 1839. Their first child was born, you know, later that year, I believe, William Darwin. They moved out of London, he and Emma, and their firstborn, to this very nice country house just south of London, where he pretty much stayed put, you know, except for seaside holidays. You know,
right.
The family would go to the Isle of Wight or other places, you know, just kind of taking in, you know, the sunshine and the nice sea air. So interestingly enough, all of these really remarkable insights were all developed literally at home. You know,
right.
He did not travel again to any significant degree. And so all of these experiments, the observations, the connecting of dots, it all kind of took place right there in his yard, in the meadows, in the woodlands, in his study, which I find fascinating, you know, that all of these insights really come from that site, from his home.
Yeah. And so, okay, so let's talk about some of the work he did, some of those experiments and observations he performed there, using, like you say in the book, friends and family and his children, and it was a very collegial atmosphere. Give us some examples of experiments he ran, and maybe that we could run in our own backyards.
Oh gosh, like where do you begin?
Right, you have 18 of them in the book.
I know. And, you know, and of course, I use experiment in a very broad sense, the way he did. You know, the modern use of the word experiment, of course, is a very strict definition that has to do with, you know, with controls and replications and, you know, and those sorts of things. You know, investigation in a broader sense is more like what he was doing. And so some of it is observational, and, you know, some of it really is manipulative. And so, you know, whether it's observational, like dissecting barnacles, you know, or orchids, or ferreting out the mysteries of what he called the buzzing places, you know, the behavior of these bumblebees in his garden, all sorts of things, you know, people can do today, you know, in that same spirit. They can make the very same observations that he made. They can also perform, you know, some of the some of the experiments. Like, for example, a fun one is, you know, Darwin in thinking about dispersal and thinking about how species make it to remote islands like the Galapagos. He fancied that, you know, besides the obvious, you know, being carried by birds or something, seeds of plants maybe simply float out to sea. And, and you know, his friends, you know, the serious naturalists just thought that was just absurd, you know, just ridiculous, the idea that seeds could actually survive, you know, exposure to salt water for any length of time, and let alone make it out to some remote speck of land. And so he undertook this series of experiments that involve floating seeds in salt water and then sampling them at different intervals to see if they retained their vitality and that he could germinate them. And a spin-off of that was looking at duck's feet, you know, as vehicles for carrying aquatic organisms. And he had a terrarium, or an aquarium rather, with aquatic snails that he called a snailery. And I give instructions for making model duck's feet in place of his real duck feet, which he actually used to dangle in the snailery to see if snails would climb on board. And what I found is kind of fun in that same spirit is to make a model duck's foot and then attach it to a drop line or a fishing line of some kind and cast it out into a lake or a pond and let it float around. And then see, indeed, you can reel that in, and, you know, after a few days or a week or a month, you can see what kinds of aquatic organisms may have colonized that that artificial duck's foot, you know, and that's very much in that Darwinian spirit.
Right.
Know.
And I remember, I think I read that even his young son, maybe 10 or so at the time, developed his own theory that perhaps seeds were being carried by dead animals within the gut of dead animals that floated
yes.
too. How about that?
Yes. And it says something that, you know, Darwin, he would not dismiss, you know, even the seemingly silliest of ideas.
Right.
Not that this was a silly idea, but,
no, but
it says something that he was open to his young son's idea that, hey, wait a minute, what about the possibility that, you know, birds might eat seeds and the seeds are in the crop of the bird and then is flying out over open ocean and suddenly is struck dead, you know, by lightning or hail or something, you know. And then the poor bird is, you know, plummets to the surface and floats around and decomposes and maybe would be washed up on some distant shore. And maybe the seeds would germinate, you know, and you would have the rotting carcass kind of fertilizing the seeds. And Darwin, in one letter to his friend Joseph Hooker, he described this. I call it Frankie's experiment. You know, I think he was 8 at the time. And he said, no sooner said than done, you know, and he had selected a poor hapless pigeon from his, you know, he kept quite a few pigeons. And indeed, he performed this experiment, having this poor pigeon, you know, float and decompose in an aquarium for a month and then planted it. And indeed, the seeds germinated. He said they germinated splendidly. You know, he was very excited about this.
Now you could run that experiment.
He's got a strong stomach, too.
You can run that experiment, Swan or Nature Preserve. Nell is the executive director of the local nature preserve here.
Ah.
So this book will come in handy for some of your summer
for
classes.
Observations on the preserve.
Hey, we only have a couple more minutes, but I did want to touch on one thing Darwin believed in or had some insights into. That there was, correct me if I'm wrong, he had a thought there was a connection between plants and animals.
Ah, yeah.
I know we only have a few minutes, but if you could just kind of summarize what that was about.
Okay, yeah, I can do that very, very quickly. Well, you know, one of Darwin's big ideas was the universal relationship of all species. And he thought that you should be able to find evidence of that, right? So that even seemingly very, very different groups of organisms, like plants and animals, at some fundamental level, there have to be commonalities. And he thought that you could maybe see them best in those animals that had plant-like qualities and those plants that had animal-like qualities. Mm. And that's what led him to explore the behavior, quote-unquote, and the physiology, the digestive physiology of carnivorous plants, you know, like sundews and flytraps, He was also interested in climbing plants for the same reason, because those tendrils, they almost seem like they can see somehow. You know, yeah. they have touch perception, and they have the ability to sort of behave in a way, right? They're seeking out supports, and then the vine is climbing up this support. So he was fascinated by that and really made a number of fundamental discoveries in both with both carnivorous plants and climbing plants.
Yeah, I wonder, because I have plants in my kitchen, and the tendrils of one are seemingly headed every day. They seem to head in a direction towards another plant's stalk or so.
Uh-huh.
How does it know that?
How does the plant know
that there is a structure that it can reach out towards in that direction? So I guess Darwin was thinking it must have some measure of cognition or something.
Yeah, and that's the way it would seem, that it seems uncanny that they have the ability to find these supports.
Right.
And of course, what we're not noticing is that the plant is always moving very, very slowly. Like in plant time, you know, that tendril or that growing shoot is tracing a circle, you know, very, very slowly, so that at any one time when we glance at it, we don't notice it. But Darwin took the time to watch very, very closely and track how these things move, and kind of revealed the secret of how they ultimately find and then respond to a solid stimulus, you know, a support that they can then sort of seize and grow up onto. But to the casual observer, it's uncanny that they look like they must be looking around, you know.
Yes.
It gives them something of a sinister quality, I think.
It does. It does. Oh, what Darwin would do for time-lapse photography.
I know.
Oh, absolutely.
Time, right? The things he could do. Hey, we have to wrap up. James Costa, the author of the new book, Darwin's Backyard, How Small Experiments Led to a Big Theory. Thank you so much for taking this extended time to chat with us this morning on This Green Earth, James.
Oh, it was a great pleasure. Thank you for the invitation. Much appreciated.
All right. Let's take a quick break for an underwriter. When we come back, we want to cover those news items, what's going on in Bonn, Germany.
Germany.
Germany, yeah.
That's right.
It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Support for KPCW programming and American Roots is proudly sponsored in part by Donna Van Buren of the Van Buren Management Group and founder of Greater Park City Properties, managing HOAs since 1985. Information for Van Buren Management at 649-0652 or vanburenmgt.com.
Hey, we're back. It's This Green Earth. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And we've got, we got about 5 or 6 minutes to cover a couple of news items, most important of which is some things going on over in Germany with respect to the Paris Climate Accords.
That's right. So I think we're hearing about the climate conference. What is this? It's actually the 23rd annual conference of the parties under the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. And that's interesting to me because we've been meeting about climate change for 23 years, under this.
While this administration says, quote unquote, we're just barely beginning to scratch the surface of our understanding of climate change. Okay.
Right. And the conference started on the 6th and it goes through the 17th. So it's, you know, nearing its end here. The main goal of this year's meeting is to kind of lay out the details of the Paris Climate Accord. The Paris Climate Accord was put in place, but it's pretty broad, pretty vague. And so one of the big goals for this conference was to hammer out the details. At this point, it kind of remains to be seen. One interesting thing about this year's conference is that, so each year it's run by a different designated nation.
Okay.
And this year they chose Fiji's prime minister representing small island nations to run the conference. So that I think was kind of a symbolic move as far as those countries being impacted so heavily. You know, we talk about sea level rise and those kinds of things.
Right. So that's going on, and there is a U.S. delegation or two delegations there now?
So this is interesting. There is the official U.S. delegation that is in Bonn, and then there is also this like secondary delegation that's unofficial, but that of course is led by Michael Bloomberg. And I have to read this like description from the reporter that was there. It's a nearly 27,000 square foot inflatable tent adorned with American flags and red, white, and blue signs proclaiming that states, cities, and businesses are, quote, still in the Paris Agreement, despite President Trump's vow to leave it. The alternate American pavilion, as it's being called, has a free espresso truck, tins of themed M&Ms, and wireless internet that tells new users as they sign on that the U.S. has not gone dark on climate action. And so there's, some really high profile people leading this delegation, including Michael Bloomberg, who's the former mayor of New York.
Right.
Governor Jerry Brown of California. Of course, Al Gore is over there. This pavilion and this delegation has gotten a huge amount of attention. But I do think that it's also causing a little bit of maybe confusion is the wrong word, but, you know, I think from what you read, the other countries are kind of like, who do we talk to? You know,
right.
We have
who's
the official delegation saying that that climate change maybe probably doesn't exist. And so then that leads me to yesterday, Trump wasn't there himself, but the administration kind of made its debut by giving a, quote, full-throated defense of fossil fuels and nuclear energy as answers to driving down global greenhouse gas emissions. But they're also saying that climate change probably isn't happening, even though they're presenting these fossil fuel, quote, solutions to this non-existent problem. It's like there are lots of...
It's kind of like a doctor saying that, hey, good news, it's not cancer, but we still recommend chemotherapy. Because they're saying it's not happening, but here's how we...
But like if it was...
But we need to have clean coal and clean natural gas, and here's how you do it.
Right.
So it's a total disconnection, cognitive dissonance on this whole thing.
It is. And lots of people are commenting on that. Like, and
what
also,
did Michael Bloomberg say? It's, his analogy was like,
it's like showing up at a cancer conference representing the tobacco industry or something along those lines. But there's been a lot, and there's been a lot of coverage on this. There was a huge protest, of course, at that official U.S. presentation of the fossil fuel information. There were a huge group of people that walked out, leaving sort of the auditorium half empty, and then other protesters that remained continued to protest throughout the presentation. The U.S. delegation brought like somebody from Peabody Energy, a massive coal company.
Yeah, and Murray Energy.
And Murray Energy several other
that we have to,
fossil fuel
in order to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, we have to continue to burn fossil fuels. That's their, Lewis Carroll version of what's going on, what we need to do.
Yeah, I like that. I like that comparison. And meanwhile, they were also addressing the Heartland Institute in Texas,
they're well known
far right.
Established fossil
climate
fuel
denier
huggers.
Yeah.
So here's what I got. It says under the Paris Deal, the Paris Climate Accords, the world's nations vow to hold the rise in global temperatures since the start of the Industrial Revolution to well below 2 degrees Celsius, which is 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. For that to happen, scientists say global emissions from power plants, factories, cars, and trucks, as well as those from land use, change, and deforestation, would need to peak in just a few years and then, are you ready for this? Decline swiftly to zero before the end of the century. So we have to get to zero now.
We need to get moving quickly. Hey, the end of the century, though, that's a lot of time. If we move quickly.
But here's part of the challenge. One example, Bangladesh. Bangladesh plans on building 25 new coal-fired power plants by 2022. Okay, now they're big in renewables, too. They're trying to do what they can. They signed on to the accords. But they're trying to get out of poverty. They're trying to address poverty. And so they plan to build 25 new coal-fired power plants in the next 5 years. That's five power plants a year, a new power plant every 10 weeks for the next 5 years, okay? That's the challenge that these third world countries are trying to address poverty, and fossil fuels are part of the equation for them because coal is inexpensive.
Seems to be more accessible. But how amazing would it be if, you know, through some support, these companies could sort of skip that phase, skip that dirty fossil fuel phase where they have to deal with all of the ramifications of that,
right,
and move right into these cleaner technologies.
And there's efforts afoot there too.
But these are the challenges
as countries like India and China, whose actual carbon consumption have gone up over the last year or two, they're facing. They have billions of people they're trying to bring up to the middle class or just out of poverty. So the problem is very, very complex. But that's what we got. That's what's happening in Bonn.
Yeah. And, you know, I will not be here next week. There will be a guest co-host in my place, of course. But I'm sure that you guys will follow up on the...
We will.
On the final outcomes of this, what gets decided, right?
Okay, my co-host, if you're interested in being a co-host.
Unless it's just you, one-man show.
I will follow up.
Monologue.
With the craziness going on in Bonn. Well, let's take one more break, our last break. When we come back, we'll have to wrap up, right? It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com, Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. It's time to wrap things up. Got a minute or so. Anything else you want to say, Nell?
I'm so regretful to miss next week's show. But every now and then, we all have to take a little vacation, right?
Oh, you're taking a vacation?
I am.
Are you going to do some citizen science work?
I will do my best. I will try to collect some samples.
Just
write you detailed letters that'll arrive 10 days after
Trump
I do.
Trump loads of stuff back from wherever you're going, of plants and insects.
Just throw it in my carry-on. No problems
That's
there.
That's not a problem. Hey, thanks again to James Costa, author of the book, Darwin's Backyard, How Small Experiments Led to a Big Theory. It's available now in bookstores everywhere.
Fascinating topic. About a man.
Seriously, you should get it. Look through some of the experiments and see what you can run there at Swanner.
Yeah. All right.
Why not?
We'll do it.
All right. That's your homework. Let's thank our sponsors.
Yeah. We need to thank Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Vail Epic Promise,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
Park City Mountain,
and listeners like you.
You can email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. We're always happy to learn what you want to hear about.
Sure. Citizen science.
That's right.
That worked in that sense.
Yeah.
Remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM Park City.
Remember, we've got your Wasatch back.
Hey, thanks again for joining us. NPR News is coming up shortly.